Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the popular new money lending companies, families, friends, strangers creating loans without banks. But first to Iowa, where the first presidential contest of 2008, the Iowa caucuses, will be held tomorrow night. Close races on both sides. Most polls show the Democratic race a three-way battle: Barack Obama, Hillary Rodham Clinton, and John Edwards. The Republican race seems to be between Mitt Romney and Mike Huckabee, but John McCain, fresh off a new poll that shows him way ahead in New Hampshire, may be a last-minute factor. Jill Lawrence is national political correspondent for USA Today. She joins us from Des Moines. And Jill, yesterday our analysts told us the candidates are not really talking about issues at this point. It's more like a high school election, a popularity contest. How is that playing out today?
Most of the candidates are making last-minute dashes, and I guess the most extreme example of that is Democrat John Edwards, who's doing round-the-clock all-nighters, and that is very reminiscent of college, at least to me. He's going to be making stops at little house parties all night. He'll be at coffee shops. He has events at 2 a.m., 5 a.m., you know, this sort of thing. You have to wonder how many more people are left to really make up their minds at this point, or whether that's going to influence them, but that's what people are doing.
Well, what do the polls show? I mean, let's stay with the Democratic race. We hear that it's all about the undecided, so perhaps that's his motivation.
Not that many people are undecided, but a lot of people are kind of soft in their support for various candidates. And, of course, particularly on the Democratic side, the Iowa caucus system is so complicated. There's a lot of ground to be gained if you're somebody's second choice, because unless a candidate gets 15% support of the people in the room at the caucus, then they have to choose someone else.
Well, Hillary Clinton is running a televised message on every media market in Iowa. Barack Obama running a longer-than-usual 2-minute ad. So the Democrats are really working hard. Let's look at the Republican side. John McCain, said to be gaining ground, definitely gained some ground in New Hampshire with the latest poll there. What is he doing?
Well, he got a boost a couple weeks ago when the Des Moines Register endorsed him, even though he has not been running a campaign in Iowa and he has not ever given up his opposition to ethanol subsidies, which are very important in the state. But after that endorsement, things started to move for him, and he now stands a very good chance of coming in third here. So his schedule today is pretty extraordinary. He's going to be doing several events in New Hampshire and then flying to Iowa, doing events in Des Moines and in Davenport, Dubuque, basically doing a fly around on the final night to signify that he is present. He'd like to do well here.
While John McCain is coming to Iowa, Republican Mike Huckabee is leaving. He's going to California to be on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. You know, is there a concern that Iowans might be offended, first of all, by his leaving, but also by his, I guess he's going to have to cross a picket line to be on Leno because Leno's writers are still on strike?
It is a bit of a puzzling choice, but candidates have left the state. I remember in 2004, Howard Dean made a last-minute trip to Plains, Georgia to appear with Jimmy Carter, and that was a day or two before the caucuses. So it's not unheard of, although I'm not sure exactly what he hopes to get out of a national audience at this point. You know, it might be, in some strategist's view, time better spent in Iowa.
And to Mitt Romney, he, of course, spent millions on his campaign there, much more than Huckabee, and he's seen his front-runner status erode. What's he doing today to try to change that?
Well, he's going to be in Bettendorf, Cedar Rapids, Mason City, and Des Moines today. He's basically making his closing arguments that he is the solid conservative in the race. That's the same argument that Fred Thompson will be making. And, you know, it's an argument that Governor Huckabee is making, but not everyone buys. So it's just an interesting situation. Romney had invested a lot of time and money here and had a very comfortable lead for a long time. But then Huckabee overtook him, and now Romney is rising again, and it's extremely close. And there are many observers of this race who think that Romney will pull it out, if narrowly.
Jill Lawrence, national political correspondent for USA Today. By the way, Jill, we understand there's another contest that's about to take place, that over 2,000 rental cars are going to be returned to the airports in Iowa right after the caucuses tomorrow night, 50% higher traffic as the press and the campaign, so many of them compared to, you know, recent caucuses, get out of town.
That's true. It's always a mad scramble, and Des Moines is left empty after being so busy for so long. So, yeah, I expect the airport in Des Moines is going to be completely frenzied on Friday as everybody leaves, and most of us will be going to the same place, to Manchester, New Hampshire.
Well, we'll talk to you there. Jill Lawrence, national political correspondent for USA Today, speaking to us from Des Moines. Thanks so much, Jill.
Sure, thank you.
It's January, when many people wake up to the reality of what they spent in December. And with the credit crunch caused by the housing crisis, there may not be a lot of money available for loans. That's one reason people are turning to person-to-person online lending sites. Loans between family members, friends, and complete strangers, no banks involved, and often no guarantee that a loan will be repaid. So why are they so popular? Let's start with Circle Lending. It was created here in Waltham, Massachusetts by Ashish Advani. Virgin Records mogul Richard Branson then bought the company, infused it with cash, and left Ashish in charge to negotiate loans between family members. Ashish Advani, now of Virgin Money USA, joins us in the studio. And Ashish, we understand you negotiate the terms of the agreement. Then do you handle the payments?
We do. We actually handle all the payments using a direct deposit.
With debit from someone's account.
That's right.
Okay. Why is it better for the borrower than going, let's say, to a bank?
Typically, the interest rate charged by your relatives and friends is a lot cheaper, and loans are a lot more flexible. It saves a borrower thousands of dollars in interest per year, and it keeps thousands of dollars of interest in the family.
And some of these borrowers wouldn't be able to get a loan. They have bad credit, for instance. So would you turn away a borrower if a family member says, I want to lend this money?
What we don't do is do credit scoring for them. We offered that service a few years ago, and we found that people didn't really want to check the credit. In fact, one of the reasons they go to family and friends is they can create, you know, very flexible payment schedules where they can do things like create a 40-year mortgage, not a 30-year mortgage, right, which gets the payments lower.
So what's in this for a lender? How do they get protected if they don't know the credit rating of the family member they're lending to and there's low interest, so they're not making a lot of money on the money that they lend?
Well, typically, there's about 6.1 million person-to-person loans per year already. So people are going to do this whether we exist or not.
Right.
And I think being a third party in the middle makes these loans stay on track and actually succeed. And the main reason that happens is people tend to structure these loans without us with a big lump sum payment. So it's here's $25,000 for your business startup, you know, please pay me back in 3 years. And even if the business is going well and the borrower wants to repay the uncle who's loaned them $25,000, trying to save up a lump sum is just not going to happen. And the act of creating a repayment plan really solves some of the emotional pitfalls as well in these loans. What often happens if there isn't a repayment plan, the borrower wants to take a trip and wants to spend $5,000 to go to Hawaii. And even entrepreneurs need vacations now and then. Mm-hmm. But the uncle says, I don't want you paying $5,000 to Hawaii. I want you to pay me back. Mm-hmm. And it's those types of conversations which make Thanksgiving uncomfortable, a dinner party's uncomfortable. By having a repayment plan, it's sort of like somebody's handling everything so we can go ahead and have our lives.
Well, let's take a hypothetical situation. Let's say that someone has a niece with an $8,000 student loan. Let's say that that loan was factored to be $20,000 with interest, you know, by the time she graduates in 4 years and is able to pay it off. Let's say her aunt wants to spare the niece that growth in the loan. And again, as you say, it's more about keeping the money in the family, too. You don't want that $8,000 to grow to $20,000. So let's say that aunt wants to buy the loan today. You know, she'll pay off the loan today and arrange with you to have the niece pay that back on some sort of schedule in, let's say, 4 years. How much roughly would you charge to, first of all, set up that loan?
We charge $99 for personal loans and $199 for business loans.
That's it? That's for what?
That's what it's a charge to set up a loan. We charge $9 per payment to administer the loan when we're actually handling all the repayment. In the case of the niece here, the hypothetical niece,
yes,
we'd manage the repayment of the loan after she graduates. So you wouldn't have to pay the $9 until after she graduates, and she's actually making payments. One of the benefits of loans between family and friends is you can create these repayment plans that can be deferred for as long as you want.
But I can hear somebody saying, well, what about the benefit to the lender, the aunt? You know, instead of buying out that $8,000 loan and deferring payments, she invested $8,000, let's say, in the stock market. Wouldn't she make much more money? And secondly, what about the tax benefits? Aren't you penalized if you give people money with low or no interest rates?
No. So I think the first benefit is the student or the niece is probably paying pretty high interest, probably between 12% and 17% on the loan. While you'd be perfectly happy earning 5 or 10% on the loan. So it keeps all that interest in the family. It saves her money. And for Uncle Sam, as long as you charge above the going rate, which is called the applicable federal rate, which is about 4.5%, it's not considered a gift. And for loans under $10,000, you can charge 0% and it doesn't matter.
That aunt's very happy suddenly. Ashish, who would you say, you know what, you're not a candidate for this?
For home purchases, about one-third of first-time home buyers get money from family and friends in the form of loans. For certain home buyers trying to buy homes which are beyond their reach, they shouldn't try to get more money from family to make it happen. That's the first category. Mm. I think the second category is business owners starting a business and making promises they really can't keep. One of the challenges which a lender has is trying to evaluate not only the capacity of the person to repay, but the character as well. Banks used to make decisions based on the four C's of credit: character, collateral, capacity, and credit rating. And now it's just credit rating. So if you've got a great business idea and good character and even collateral, which is not your home, you're going to have a tough time getting a bank loan unless you've got good credit. So if you're a startup, it's going to be very, very difficult to get bank financing, which is one reason why people go to family and friends in the first place. So now family and friends have to become better at evaluating.
By the way, we should say, too, that these loans that are made between family and friends, they're unsecured, which means that in the terms, one of the terms is not that you can get your brother's motorcycle if he defaults on his payment to you. There is no, you're shaking your head, there's no way to get assets from these family or friends through this process.
No, about 60% of our loans are secured. All the home loans are secured. In the case of business loans, typically they're secured with equipment or something which is recoverable. For personal loans like student loans and debt consolidation loans, they're not secured, you're right. In fact, one big benefit of securing a loan with a home is the borrower can deduct all the interest they pay, just like they would if they were taking out a bank mortgage. But people don't know that you can deduct the interest on a loan from your parents as well as what you'd get from a bank, which saves, once again, thousands of dollars a year.
Why is this happening?
Well, I think the idea of a borrower just getting, you know, money from their local bank branch somewhat outdated. I think people are looking on the web and they're looking for creative ways to save money. I think lenders, on the other hand, used to trust the stock market more than they do, and they're looking for alternative investments. The idea of, you know, having a loan to your kids at 6% for $100,000 to help them buy a home is perfectly reasonable. Plus, people aren't gifting as much as they used to because they realize that they need the money for their retirement because people are living longer. So I think those three trends are really driving the behavior of formalizing loans between family and friends.
That's why reverse mortgages is one of the things that you do.
A reverse mortgage is hot.
Let's explain. In a bank reverse mortgage, a bank takes possession of your home, you stay in it, and they pay you a certain amount of money per month?
Exactly. And they earn home equity in your home, effectively. What we do is we allow you to keep the home and the family by doing an intra-family reverse mortgage. So the adult child can earn home equity in their parents' home. For example, if they're already paying them $500 a month to live or $20,000 a year to live, what they can do is they can formalize that and earn half the home, so when their parents die, they already have half the estate.
Well, but some would say, well, wait a second, when the parents pass, the home's going to go to the child anyway.
But they will have to pay estate tax on the home. Here they already own half the home or perhaps the entire home because they've been kind of getting credit, if you want to call it that, for all the payments and support they've given their parents.
That's Ashish Advani. Ashish, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Great, thank you.
His company is the family and friends lending site Virgin Money USA. So just ahead, how about lending money to strangers? Talk about that. Later today, Caucus the Musical. Back in 1 minute here and now. We're back with more of our conversation about person-to-person loans, loans between family members, friends, or complete strangers. No banks, just companies that act as a middleman, helping lender and borrower agree to terms and then facilitating payment. There's no guarantee the money will be repaid, but as we just heard from Ashish Advani of Virgin Money USA, the upside is interest rates can be set lower and that money can stay in the family instead of going to a bank. Well, Elaine Appleton-Grant recently wrote about these online lending sites for the Boston Globe. Elaine, start with Virgin Money. What did you find?
Well, I'm very impressed by Virgin Money, and I spoke to several financial planners. I couldn't find one to criticize what Virgin Money is doing. They all were remarkably positive on it.
What would be any drawbacks if they exist?
For a very small loan, you may be better off doing it yourself.
Sure, if you're going to make a $500 loan and there's a $99 fee and then, you know, $9 or so for each payment, it really may not be cost effective. I think, by the way, when it comes to lending that size money to family members, it's called a gift.
I did have one financial planner say that many times when people would come to him and say, I'm thinking about lending money to my family member, the first thing he would say is, are you prepared to lose it? All of these sites, and they're not all geared specifically to lending money to family members, but all of these sites will facilitate an automatic payment in one way or another to the lender. And, you know, just having that automatically coming out of your checkbook is going to make the likelihood of repayment go up.
And you give one other example that's, you know, people don't think of these things, but if you give some money to a married child and that marriage fails.
Yes. I was surprised by that one because I certainly wouldn't have thought of it either. But say you lend $100,000 to your married daughter to help buy a house, and they buy a house, and 2 years later, they're getting divorced. If it's not documented, you have no way of proving that the soon-to-be ex-spouse actually owes you $50,000.
Right.
And, in fact, neither does your child have any way of proving that. And so that's going to hurt them in the divorce negotiations, how much equity they're going to have to pay, for instance, in the sale of the house.
Well, let's talk about the other websites. We've talked quite a bit about Virgin Money. How about Prosper.com or Lending Club? How do they work?
Well, they work in different ways, and I'd like to just bring one other one up as well, and that is Zopa.com. They all work in different ways, but they are all person-to-person lending sites that are designed a little bit more for strangers or for friends than they are for family. And both Prosper and Lending Club are, in a sense, marketplaces. Prosper.com is an eBay-like marketplace where, you know, I can go onto Prosper and post my profile and say, you know, I'm a journalist living up in New Hampshire and I want to borrow $5,000 to consolidate my high credit card payments and get out of debt. And here's my credit rating and here's my debt to income ratio, and won't you help me out? Then lenders bid on that loan and they will say, well, I will lend you some money at such and such an interest rate. I will also ask for the interest rate that I want. And generally, they will lend money in, say, $50 increments.
Okay, this I find just, you know, hard to believe because it's just, you said these are strangers. So let's take this one at a time. For instance, you profile someone who was looking for a $10,000 loan at an interest rate of 12%. She wanted to remodel her home. She had 96 people bidding on the loan. How does that work? Who finds out whether or not her credit is any good? And then how does the money exchange hands?
I believe that both Prosper.com and Lending Club will vet their borrowers. They won't guarantee that you're going to get repaid, so you are taking a chance. I think the downside of any person-to-person lending marketplace is the company cannot guarantee that the borrower is definitely going to repay you.
I would think that would be a big downside. You know.
Well, you know, I think it's very much according to a person's risk tolerance whether they want to jump into this or not. The upside as a lender is that it's a different form of an investment. You can make more money than you would in a savings account, for instance. And on Prosper.com, you can theoretically make quite a bit of money because you can earn an interest rate up to, I don't know, 20% on a loan if you're willing to lend to a very risky borrower.
And that's the benefit for people who go to these websites looking for lenders. They probably can't get credit anywhere else.
That is true on Prosper.com because you don't need to have a superior credit rating to borrow money on Prosper.com. Both Lending Club and this new one, Zopa, you have to have a credit rating of 640, which is the same credit rating you would need to borrow money from a bank. So why would you borrow from one of these social lending sites instead of a bank? There are a couple of reasons. One is perhaps you have a good credit rating, but you don't have the income to support the size of the loan that you want. This can be an option. Another reason is that these companies tout that their interest rates are lower than most bank interest rates.
Well, and you said that some of the lenders get involved because in some of the cases they can potentially make so much money because they can charge such a high interest rate.
Mm-hmm.
Why else would a lender get involved? Let's say it's at a low interest rate. You know, why else would someone want to give money to a perfect stranger with no guarantee that they're going to pay it back? Is there any altruism here, I guess, is the question?
Well, there appears to be. I've seen quotes from people who say that, you know, they really just sort of like knowing who they're helping out. Sort of like the international microfinance sites. There is that feeling of altruism. I talked to one analyst who follows these sites, and he went on them just recently, and he said, oh, I lent $50, and, you know, it was really fun sort of deciding who I'm going to help out. And all of these sites are sort of taking advantage of the web social network craze in that there are groups on these sites so that you could lend to someone, say, who went to your college or who lives in your neighborhood or is in your industry or has something in common with you.
You mean somebody could put together sort of a web page, if you will, at the site with an issue, our house burned down, or we're trying to do this thing for our neighborhood, we're trying to build this thing and you can invest in this. They can really, you know, paint quite a picture.
Absolutely.
Huh. That's Elaine Appleton Grant, correspondent for the Boston Globe. She wrote about family to family, family to friend, and stranger to stranger lending sites on the internet. Elaine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to check in on a small town in Iowa that's been confronted with illegal immigration. How are they feeling about the upcoming caucuses? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the music of Levon Helm. After the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Iowa caucuses are tomorrow, to which you might reply, tell me something I don't know. Okay, are you familiar with Caucus the Musical?
I remember back in 84, I went to open up my door, and there stood Walter Mondale in my yard. He'd been there since the break of dawn, that's when he mowed and raked my lawn, and walked and fed my lazy St. Bernard. When I got past the initial shock, I looked back at the kitchen clock, and saw that it was time to milk the goat. I handed him the milking pail, 'cause I was certain without fail he'd do anything for a vote.
That's a scene from Caucus the Musical, in which characters describe the lengths that real presidential candidates such as Walter Mondale have gone to in the past to get their vote. Now they're being courted by a whole new crop of fictional contenders. The play is being revived this campaign season by playwright and Iowa native Robert John Ford. It's the story of fictional Iowa farmer Eldon Wise and his family. A fictional reporter anoints them the perfect voters, and fictional but strikingly familiar presidential candidates fall all over themselves to win the family's endorsement. Robert John Ford joins us from Des Moines. Robert, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, politics and musical theater, similarities?
Absolutely. I think politics, especially here in Iowa, we are accustomed to seeing the theater of politics every 4 years, actually every 2 years anymore, because it starts about 2 years prior to each caucus season. And it is very theatrical. There's a lot of sights, a lot of sounds, and there's a certain amount of acting and song and dance involved.
Well, speaking of which, let's listen to a little of The Tough Question Sidestep.
The Tough Question Sidestep. Just dance around the issue at hand. You tease the press like you're Sally Rand, and soon they'll rub your belly at your command.
Have you ever smoked crack or marijuana? Is it true you were once jailed in Tijuana?
Do you have a restraining order from Madonna?
Yes, what have you got to say?
When they're rounding up a posse.
So, Bob, Robert John Ford, who's written this musical, what were you trying to communicate in that piece?
This song is basically the candidates' campaign managers teaching the various candidates how to dance around the issues and dance around the tough questions. It's a very fun tap dance number that we have in the show, and it's basically instructing the candidates how to get out of these tough situations that they find themselves in.
In the version that's on stage now, you have four major fictional characters that oddly resemble the current crop of contenders in many ways. So first of all, sketch them out.
Sure, and I wrote this prior to the current candidates, so it's interesting how some of them have become real. But I wrote 4 years ago or more that there would be an African-American candidate, a female candidate, a candidate who had multiple past marriages and was being scrutinized for that. And some of the situations that I wrote about, too, including the fact that we have a point in the play where a candidate's caught having a question planted in the audience. And several other scenes and issues have, what started as being fiction, have turned out to be reality in this current campaign season.
And then there's Eldon and his family. These are the fictional voters. First of all, you grew up in Iowa, so what were you pulling from to create Eldon?
What I wanted to do was initially portray this family. It's a farmer, his wife, a daughter, and son, as sort of the stereotypical Iowans, which we see in a lot of television and movies, the sugary, sweet, wholesome, pure Midwestern family. But as the play progresses, I wanted to show that they are, in fact, very real human beings with different issues and different traits. And ultimately, as the play progresses, we find out that the daughter becomes very militant and anti-war. She's very active in the anti-war movement to a point that she's become militant. The son comes out of the closet and also admits that he's a drug user. The mother finds religion in a few months and kind of goes over the top as far as how far to the right she goes with her religious views. And the father is just trying to maintain some sanity in his family once everyone goes in a different direction.
Oh, Eldon, in fact, has an aria of sorts in your musical. Let's listen to a little of What I Want.
What I want is to be a family, even though we disagree now and then.
The song actually speaks to what Eldon, as a father, wants for his family, but also as the song progresses, it's an anthem basically stating what we as Americans want in our next leader. More and more people in the ensemble join in the song, and it becomes a very driven, passionate anthem about where we stand as a country and what we really want in our future and in the next leader of the country.
What I want is to see all battles cease so our earth can live in peace before it's too late.
Is it partisan, though? There are some Americans who, you know, want to find our enemies abroad and not make peace with them. So,
right. I tried as much as I could to make it nonpartisan.
A human first, and then American.
But I think, yes, in some ways it is a little bit idealistic and maybe a bit partisan in the sense that it does express some very specific desires. It may not be the desire of every American.
I wondered, too, if it was a plea, you know, a little bit of a plea from an Iowan to just be left alone.
Well, and in fact, we do have a song at the end of this show that is called Goodbye, Good Luck, Good Riddance, which basically expresses, you know, we've been glad to have you around for the past year and a half, but we are very happy to see you go as well.
We're glad you came, but just the same.
I understand that this is a sentiment shared by the whole theater company. I mean, the stagehand talked about having, 200 robocalls, those automatic calls?
Yes. One of our lighting director says he's at the point where he just doesn't even answer the phone anymore because he felt he had already done more than 100 phone surveys through November.
Don't let the door hit you.
So, by the way, what does Eldon ultimately choose? What happens to him?
Eldon ultimately sees that there are more choices than the four major presidential candidates that have been presented to him throughout the play. And Eldon ultimately does find a second-tier candidate that he feels more comfortable with.
Yeah. Well, this coming weekend, the New Hampshire Theater Project in Portsmouth is going to premiere an adaptation of your musical, Caucus the Musical. Theirs is going to be called what?
The Primary Primary, and it's basically a similar script. We adapted it for New Hampshire, but I think we in Iowa and those people in New Hampshire are experiencing the same things every 4 years, so we felt it would translate quite well to New Hampshire.
Well, that's playwright Robert John Ford. His musical Caucus, the musical, runs through January 13th in Des Moines. His adaptation, The Primary Primary, premieres in Portsmouth, New Hampshire on January 4th. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Robert, good luck with it all.
Thank you very much.
The Juno Jumpers are a rope-skipping team from Southeast Alaska, and five of the group's members are busy gearing up for the 2008 World Jump Rope Competition. Producer Rebecca Shear stopped by one of their practices and learned the difference between crabs and frogs, the reason suicide should be attempted by only the most agile, and the number of rope skips it takes to beat the Guinness World Record.
If you've never heard the sound of a jump rope spinning at about 60 miles an hour, take a listen to this. You hear that sound a lot when the Juno Jumpers are around. The co-ed rope skipping team boasts 32 members from elementary school to college age who perform and compete across the state and country, dazzling spectators and judges not only with their lightning fast jumping, but with their complex choreography and gymnastics.
You can do a push-up, a split, a crab, a frog's the handstand one, or when Grayson flips, like a front flip and lands with one leg out, it's called a suicide.
Kind of an extreme name for a jump roping move, but then this is kind of an extreme sport. And Haley Summers, a high school senior who joined the Juno Jumpers in third grade, has the bruises to prove it.
I have some pretty good bruises on the back of my legs. I get some scars.
Yeah, we had a friend once who went to school and she had all these whip marks from the rope, and her teacher was like, "Are you having problems in the home?"
Oh, that was me.
Really?
No.
Oh, it was Lindsay.
No.
Haley's teammates, Isabel Bush and Tara Ross, have also been jumping a long time. They started on their elementary school's satellite teams.
Juno Jumpers started with one elementary school in 1987.
This is Jan Rutherdale, president of the Juno Jumpers Board of Directors.
As the sport sort of took off and everybody got excited about it in Juno, they had about 50 people on their team, which is really too much for one little gym. And so they started encouraging. They said, well, you could start a program at your elementary school.
There are now six of these programs, including the Auk Bay Ropers, the Gastineau Skippers, and the Harborview Hoppers. Students learn the basics on these school-wide teams. Then in third grade, they can try out for the citywide team.
You have to do 60 double unders and have 90 in 1 minute speed.
There's also a routine that we've constructed with some basic tricks that everybody has to complete to make the team too.
That's 15-year-old Grayson Carlisle, the one who does that not-so-basic trick, the suicide. He helps lead the practice sessions that the team offers prior to tryouts. As for those other bits of jump rope jargon, let's start with the double under.
That means the rope going under you two times. For every rotation, you're jumping up.
Again, Jan Rutherdale.
It takes incredible strength. I can do two of them in a row. And they say if you can do two, you can slowly build up, but I just never tried.
Then there's the one-minute speed, a miniature version of the three-minute speed, a typical competition event.
A three-minute speed is equivalent to a 100-meter dash or 200 or something like that. You have to have endurance.
And plenty of it. At today's practice, the Juno Jumpers are doing a three-minute double Dutch speed relay with two ropes, two twirlers, and one jumper, who's actually doing more of a hyper-caffeinated jog. They all take turns jumping, and after 3 minutes, you add up everyone's jumps.
I counted yours, it was 88.
For competition, we should really be going for 550, probably.
And the Juno Jumpers have quite a big competition coming up. In January, five of them, including Isabel, Grayson, and Haley, are trying out for the 2008 World Jump Rope Competition, to be held in Cape Town, South Africa in July. Even though Isabel made it to the 2004 Worlds in Brisbane, Australia, she's still pretty anxious.
The problem with jump rope is, you can nail it every time in practice, but if you go out there and it's just that one time, and so get really nervous, I guess, for that.
But even if after all the double unders and suicides and whips and bruises, the team doesn't make it to Cape Town in 08, the Juno Jumpers still hold a place on the international jump roping map. Just pick up a copy of the 2007 Guinness Book of World Records. On page 93, under the title Most Skips in a Day, you'll find a rather familiar name, Isabel Bush. And though it isn't listed in the book, the name of the person who counted all 151,036 of those jump rope skips? Haley Summers.
Producer Rebecca Shear in Juneau, Alaska. For more on the Juno Jumpers, go to our website, here-now.org. Back in 1 minute with a review of new music from Levon Helm, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and this is a voice many people thought they'd never hear again. That's Levon Helm, the singing drummer from the band. His voice animated classic 1960s hits like The Wait, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, and Up on Cripple Creek.
Up on Cripple Creek, she sends me if I spring a leap. She mends me, I don't have the speed. And she defends me, a drunkard's dream if I ever did see one.
The band broke up 30 years ago, and since then, Helm has faced a series of calamities, a dismal solo career, a number of bankruptcies, the death of two bandmates, and most recently, a singer's nightmare. He was diagnosed with throat cancer. But after surgery, 28 radiation treatments, and a long rest, Helm's back with his first solo recording in 25 years, and it's been nominated for a Grammy as Best Traditional Folk Album. Joining us with more, music critic Tim Riley. Tim, hello.
Hi, Robin.
How does he sound to you?
Oh, well, I think he sounds great. I mean, to start with, the number of drummers who are also singers, you can count them on one hand.
Don Henley.
And you'd have to pick his singing over his drumming with Don Henley. With Levon Helm, you would be really hard-pressed to choose. Do you want this guy to sing or play drums? You always want him to be doing both, and he's one of those rare creatures who can do both really, really well.
But what else makes this new recording from Levon Helm so special to you?
Well, he has gone back to his childhood as an Arkansas boy, and I read somewhere that his hometown in Arkansas was Turkey Scratch, Arkansas. So these are songs that he learned as an Arkansas boy, like this old song called Poor Old Dirt Farmer, the title song from the CD.
Now the poor old dirt farmer, he's a left all alone.
That the band took the idea of Americana and gave rock and roll an historical weight that tied it up with a lot of older traditional material. So he seems to still be doing what he did.
That's right, only he's doing it further back. You have to understand the context. The band appeared at a time in rock history when psychedelia was all the rage. And the band came out making what we now know as roots rock, the country, the R&B, and the blues music that came together as rock and roll. And so what Helms is doing now in his solo career is he's going even further back, and he's taking traditional songs from, say, the last century that were passed along in the oral tradition. And what it does is gives him a really persuasive way to become an aging rocker, which is what the dilemma that all these rock and rollers face is. How do you be 68 and sing rock and roll?
Well, you say like Mick Jagger just keeps pretending that he's 16, whereas Levon Helm, what he's doing, it would be like a movie star going back and making a silent
film.
That's
the comparison that comes to mind, is if you had like a leading movie star go back and make a silent movie, and then you would see, oh, they understand completely the properties of cinema that make movies so persuasive. This is what Levon Helm is doing through song, and he's making several arguments at once. One is that rock and roll has very deep roots. The other is that these songs really were the rock and roll of their time, like this song, False Hearted Lover.
False hearts have been my downfall. Pretty women have been my grave. I'm sure
not only being a pleasure for those of us who are fans, this sounds like this CD came just in time for him. Let's talk a little bit about that backstory. The bankruptcies, the battle with throat cancer.
Well, yeah, no, he's been through a lot, especially in the past 10 years. He has an estate in upstate New York in Woodstock, And he has this old barn that he's converted into a stage slash recording studio, which is where this record was made. And he holds these jam sessions with his friends and with, you know, visiting luminaries like Emmylou Harris and Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe. And they're called Midnight Rambles. And he discovered through holding these very popular Midnight Rambles that he could charge enough admission to bail himself out of bankruptcy a couple of times and save this estate. And so when he fell ill with cancer and he started getting radiation treatment, this became an even more vivid connection to him with the music. He was drumming all the way through, even though he couldn't sing. And it was only very slowly after he finished radiation treatments, a period of several years, that he began singing kind of tentatively. So it's been a long road.
And sing with a vengeance. Let's hear a little more from the CD. What's next?
Well, you can hear this joy of being back in full voice in a song like Got Me a Woman.
Oh, I got me a woman. She's a pretty good woman at that. We live with a monkey and a Chinese acrobat. She calls me, texts, makes me wear a cowboy hat. But I don't care, she's a pretty good woman at that. Nothing in the world make me treat that woman mean. She shaves my beard and she keeps my tractor clean. She burns my bread, makes me eat turnip greens. But I don't care, she's the best little woman I've seen.
Tim, Levon Helm talked in a way about his music roots in The Last Waltz. That's the classic Martin Scorsese documentary of the band's farewell performance at the Winterland Ballroom in San Francisco back in 1976. Let's listen to a clip from the film in which he gives sort of a skeletal definition of rock and roll.
That's kind of the middle of the country, you know, back there. So bluegrass or country music. You know, if it comes down to that area, yeah, and if it mixes there with rhythm and if it dances, yeah, then you've got a combination of all those different kinds of music. Country, bluegrass, blues music.
A melting pot.
Show music.
And what's it called then?
Rock and roll.
Rock and roll, yes.
Sure.
Exactly.
Levon Helm in the documentary The Last Waltz, which was co-produced by Helm's fellow band member Robbie Robertson. Some call it the greatest rock and roll film ever, but Levon Helm didn't.
Helm doesn't like it because he thinks it makes Robbie Robertson look like a big celebrity movie star. And as he writes in his book, you know, there's Robbie Robertson with his Hollywood haircut. And it doesn't really show off the band for what it was, which was really a true ensemble. Three lead singers, Helm and Danko and Richard Manuel. And it's kind of preposterously pretentious. These are young men in their 30s talking about the end of the road and hanging it up and everything. And it's really like bizarre. It's like, and they've got Muddy Waters standing there singing. And he, you know, towers over the whole movie. And here are these kids talking about what a tough life they've had on the road. And it really just is it's kind of bizarre.
Well, but back to Levon Helm's new CD. He did have the tough road. And interestingly, he closes his new CD with a new song by Buddy and Julie Miller. It's called Wide River to Cross, Thinly Veiled.
Well, yeah, it's a thinly veiled metaphor for his own experience, of course. And it's a terribly cliched or overwrought image. And yet, you know, when Levon Helm sings it, you really believe him.
I'm only halfway home. I've got to journey on to where I'll find the thing that I've lost.
Levon Helm singing A Wide River to Cross from his new recording, Dirt Farmer, his first solo release in 25 years. Here Now's Tim Riley has been filling us in. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Tim, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
I've got a wide river to cross. I've got a wide river to cross.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.